Kia ora, and good morning, Sue.
Good morning to you.
Sue, you've been with the Greens for many years now, and of course you're with Wellington City Council, and you've always been working for the public good, and now you're involved with food and health issues for the Green Party. So could you tell us what you are currently working with?
Well, at any one time there are so many different issues, but if I cast my mind back over the last week, one of the issues is, for example, my concern that the Labour Party, or the Minister of Health, has come to some deal with Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola, and basically said, if we remove sugar-filled drinks from our schools, can we do a deal that we are going to be allowed to keep our vending machines and keep our diet-filled or diet drinks, soft drinks, in schools? And this really concerns me because, really, first of all, it's going to mean that the vending machines selling fizzy drinks remain in our schools. And I think, you know, why would we do that when the government's talking about the need for, you know, healthy schools and encouraging kids to have healthy choices? Well, encouraging them to drink fizzy drinks is not a healthy choice because they've got no nutritional value whatsoever. And even if they are the diet drinks, I mean, some people think they're almost worse than the sugar-filled drinks because not only do they contain the caffeine, which, of course, is an addictive substance and affects children's nervous systems, you know, quite strongly and can actually make kids, you know, hyperactive and hard to teach, they also are very, very acidic. They contain phosphoric acid, and so they can destroy the enamel on children's teeth. But also they contain the most controversial additive in the food supply, which is aspartame, and that is an artificial sweetener which has huge concerns around its safety. You know, there's a huge debate about, you know, whether it ever should have been approved in the first place, and secondly, there are persistent huge numbers of side effects reported from aspartame, but also, you know, some animal studies saying, well, look, they're finding that it's caused cancer in animals. So it is a very controversial additive, and for all of these reasons, I don't think we should have diet drinks in our schools, and I'm deeply disappointed that the Minister of Health has just gone ahead and done this deal to keep them in the schools, because I, you know, met with the Minister, I wrote to him, I presented him with a whole raft of research about aspartame and the other effects, you know, adverse effects diet drinks, and he's chosen to ignore all of that research.
Yes, is big business or big money leaning on the government in this one too, do you think?
Well, I think it's perhaps more a matter that the government doesn't want to do anything to get offside with big business. I think in the first year of the government, when they introduced the Employment Relations Act, they got a huge fright because the whole business community organised a very major campaign against the government and its ratings plummeted. And I think the government decided then and there that they would follow Tony Blair in the so-called third way, which involves, you know, being much more cautious, never getting offside with government and just focusing on, you know, incremental changes and ensuring that they never alienate significant sectors of the population, but most of all big business, and get themselves re-elected. And so it's all justified in terms of, well, this is the way to get ourselves re-elected. But what it does mean is that the government is incredibly reluctant to get offside with an industry group, particularly one as powerful as the food industry.
Yes, because they just want to stay in power. I can understand that. So with the vending machines, does that mean they're also going to keep on with all the other snacks like chocolate bars and potato chips?
Well, at the moment, they have, you know, those are available in schools. But they are bringing out some guidelines next year, which will require schools to implement over the next few years. And they will say that, you know, there are certain types of foods that can't be sold. And I think that that would cover most of those things like the chips and the chocolate bars. I think basically they're going to move to saying you can only sell healthy food that has a sort of green light. You know, there's a traffic light system whereby you divide food between green light for healthy food, amber for sort of some questions, and red for food that you should only eat sparingly. And so I think that they're going to be introducing these new guidelines to schools. But the problem is, for example, that the guidelines will obviously be saying that diet drinks are healthy food, which quite obviously they're not. So it all depends on what their definition of healthy food is.
Yes, and that swings right round, of course, and brings in trans fats and oils. And I'm really interested in the fact that New York is now eliminating trans fats. Can you give us an angle on this, please?
Well, trans fats are artificial fats that are used in the food industry, and they don't have any nutritional value. In fact, they have increasingly people realise that they have that they're a significant contributor to heart disease, you know, coronary heart disease. And basically, what they do is they take an oil and they bubble hydrogen through it, and it makes it more, you know, it makes it sort of fat soluble and sort of hardens the oil, makes it much easier for the food manufacturers to use. So you can make perfectly shaped, the same shaped size biscuits and that sort of thing with the trans fats. Very you know, useful for food manufacturers, but increasingly people have realized that they are a significant contributor to coronary heart disease, and actually nutritionists around the world are saying many are starting to say they're worse than saturated fats, and that because they're synthetic, they have no nutritional value whatsoever. They're saying, let's get rid of these things, because in doing so, we'll reduce a significant risk of coronary heart disease. And so, yes, New York has moved to get rid of them. Denmark has moved to, well, all of its food manufacturers have agreed not to have more than 1% of trans fats in their foods. And even, I mean, most, countries like America all require trans fats to be declared on the label. New Zealand is way behind on this. In fact, I think most New Zealanders, you know, there's a very low awareness of trans fats or indeed the health concerns around them. And so I have been calling, the Green Party's been calling in the first instance for the labelling of trans fats so that we're actually aware of the trans fat content of food so we can avoid them if we wish. But secondly, we think that the government should be taking leadership on this issue, requiring the food industry to eliminate trans fats from the food supply, or at least say, you know, no more than 1% of any food could contain trans fats. And even across the Tasman in Australia, the Australian government has got together a high-level group to aim to do just that in Australia. So really, we're lagging way behind in failing to deal with trans fats, which pose such a risk to you know, particularly for coronary heart disease.
There's a big advert here in Auckland by the motorway. It says, "Honey, we're killing the kids," and it's to do with this TV program. I think it's on 3. Fish and chips is a big no-no.
Well, there's nothing wrong with fish, of course.
I understand.
But the oils that they cook the you know, the fish and chips in, tend to be, well, they tend to be reused and reused, which of course is a major problem right there. But they tend to be, you know, the very saturated fats, or many of the fish and chips are found to have very high trans fatty acid content as well. McDonald's recently announced that they were seeking to drastically reduce the trans fatty acids in their products, and good on them for doing that. But the rest of the food industry needs to follow suit.
And oils. I've been told that extra virgin olive oil, organic, is the best, but also coconut oil. Is this? Can you add to this?
Well, you know, there's a lot of, you know, different. Some people argue that coconut oil is still a, you know, or that is a risk. But personally, I think coconut oil is a very good oil, and of course, you can't get beyond olive oil, and in particular, as you say, the extra virgin organic oils. And we're very fortunate that we're now having developing an oil industry in New Zealand, and we have got some wonderful, although expensive, New Zealand grown oils, because you know, I think really we don't know too much when you get these oils coming out from excuse me, from Spain or wherever. We don't really know how they've been produced, and you know, obviously extra virgin is the best, but it is a problem that it's unaffordable for many New Zealanders, obviously, with our, you know, because we have such a high proportion of people on a low income. Many of these you know, very healthy foods like extra virgin olive oil are really unaffordable to them, and that is, of course, a major problem.
I understand. And could you tell us a little bit about folate? What is the story with folate in bread?
I'm not sure what you mean by the story.
Some people say we should put it in the bread. Others say no, we should allow bread to remain bread. And if you want to get folate, it's in the, you get that out of green leafy vegetables. Is that right?
Yes. Well, I mean, basically, there's a, you know, not just in New Zealand, but in America and other countries, there's some research has shown that if you have, that we'll put it this way, that low amounts of folic acid can be a risk factor in producing children with spina bifida. So there's been this big move to, you know, to fortify bread, to mandatorily add folate to bread in the hope that this will reduce the numbers of people with spina bifida, which I think is about 50 children a year are born with spina bifida. And the Food Standards Australia New Zealand is considering this issue, and they're considering recommending that all bread that is sold in New Zealand will be fortified with folate. But there are concerns about that. If you have too much folic acid, then that can mask a vitamin B deficiency, which doesn't sound very serious, a vitamin B deficiency, but it actually, a vitamin B deficiency can be very serious indeed. And, you know, I know people who have had to have blood transfusions and, you know, end up in hospital because they've had a vitamin B12 deficiency. So the issue is, do we need to fortify bread for everybody to target, you know, the people who are, you know, women who are getting pregnant? Is this the best way to go about it? And from the Green Party's point of view, we think the key thing here, you know, we accept that there is some evidence that putting folate, that we are deficient in folic acid, but we think that there must be some consumer choice preserved here, and we want to see all organic and speciality breads at the very least exempted, but we still think that there are significant you know, issues around the whole proposal for mandatory fortification as well. You know, there's a whole lot of questions that still that haven't really been answered, or it hasn't really been thought through. And it's a big step when you just go into this, you know, mandatory fortification. And of course, the underlying reason is that more and more of the food we eat, because it's, when you highly process food, you of course you destroy most of the vitamins and nutrients in that food. And so we're eating, and then of course the soil that we've been growing food in, progressively the soil has been getting worse. We've been pouring pesticides over it and nitrates, and so not, you know, restoring the fertility of the soil. So more and more of our food has been grown in nutrient-poor soils. I think in the United Kingdom they did a study and they said they found that the nutrient content of their soils had declined by about 50% over the last number of decades. So basically, the upshot of all of these trends is that we are eating food which is, you know, deficient in nutrients. And therefore, it's not just folate. They're now saying we're deficient in iodine, and they're considering having mandatory iodine fortification of our food. And then there's a few, we're deficient in lots of nutrients, mainly because we're eating so much of this highly processed food, which is where the nutrients have been destroyed. And then, of course, many of these farming techniques mean that the nutrient content, even of fresh vegetables and that, is greatly diminished. So the underlying problem is that we're not eating enough fresh, whole foods, and preferably ones that have been organically grown. Because, for millennia, we've only ever eaten organically. It's only just in the last, 50 to 100 years that we've stopped eating food organically and started, eating sort of what many people call industrial food, but food that's been grown, with the use of synthetic fertilizers and pesticides and so forth. So I think that is the underlying problem, that our food has not been, much of it isn't being produced in a way that we actually retain the nutrients in it.
Yes, and of course the Greens are pushing for organic by 2020, and I know that in Sweden that 80% of the produce that they produce in that country is organic, and there's something like 25,000 organic farms in Austria. So there are a number of countries that who are leading, and of course Europe is a good market. If we look, of course, the food miles possibly make it a bit awkward, but New Zealanders have yet really to embrace organic, aren't
yes,
they?
Yes, it's extraordinary, isn't it? When I say to people, how much, if I'm talking about organics, I say, how much of New Zealand agriculture do you think is in organic production? Most people say, 5%, maybe more. The lowest people usually go to is 1%. And I have to say to them, I'm afraid, sadly, not even 1% of our land is in organic production. Only 0.24% of our land is in organic production. And most people are deeply shocked. And I think the reason is that if you're going to move towards organic production, there needs to be government support and institutional support to help farmers, particularly in the early days of conversion to organics, because to as you all know, that if you've got a conventional farm and you want to switch to organics, there's about a two or three year period of transition before you can claim your organic certification. But during that time, you can't use the synthetic, fertilizers and pesticides. So that there is that period when the farmer is going to, have a dramatically reduced income. So overseas, what they do is, in Europe and that, they actually help farmers in that period of conversion. And they do so because they say that the environmental benefits of organic farming are so huge that it's worth effectively subsidizing farmers for the initial period to enable them to make the transition. So, yes, in Europe, you're right. In Austria and Denmark and Sweden, they're in Germany, they're getting to very high amounts of organic production. Some of them are up to 20% now in Austria. And here we are way, way behind. And it is extraordinary. And I think there has been hostility within some of the institutions, like MAF, et cetera, or certainly resistance to organic farming. And I think that perhaps it's because our MAF and the the Ministry of Agriculture are all focused on our exports. And I think they're worried that if we focus on organic production, people might start to ask, hang on a minute, what's happening to our conventional food production? I'm assuming this is one of the reasons, because they've been incredibly reluctant to embrace organic agriculture, and indeed some of them, like the head of the Food Safety Authority, are sort of running around saying there's absolutely no difference between organic food and conventionally grown food, and, you know, this, organic food isn't healthier for you, and they're actually trying to sort of undermine the whole organic brand, which is quite bizarre. And so really, with the Green Party, we have these things called budget bids, where we can secure funding for certain projects. And this is because of an agreement we have with the government that we won't vote against them, we don't vote for them on confidence and supply, and in return we have these budget bids. So I secured funding for an organics advisory service this year, and that's being implemented even as we speak, and that's basically going to enable the development of advisory and research services, so that farmers who are contemplating converting or have converted can actually have access to advice. Because, I mean, at the moment there's been virtually nobody even there to help the organic farmer. And of course the organic farmer, instead of relying on, you know, just on sort of squirting pesticides or fertilizer, they have to work with nature, with, you know, they have to use the sort of traditional knowledge to find other methods than pesticides to grow foods, you know, and without undermining the fertility of the soil, and without using pesticides. So it needs a lot of knowledge and experience to do this. And so this organic advisory service is will help farmers at least to have that, to have that knowledge and information. And I think that's been very much welcomed within the organic industry. But that's really the first time that we're starting to see in New Zealand some assistance for organic farmers. I mean, until now, they've effectively been penalised because they have to pay all the, you know, environmental costs, if you like, of being an organic farmer, and of being a good steward on their land, and they have to also, it's expensive to get organic certification. You've got to have people coming in to certify, to you know, check that your soil, etc., is that meets organic standards. Whereas conventional farmers don't pay most of the conventional environmental costs of conventional farming. They don't have to pay for them. Nor do they have to get certification. I mean, you know, no one's coming in and inspecting their farms and checking out what pesticides they've been using. And, you know, all that nutrient runoff, you know, from the fertilizers that they, that conventional farmers use, that's off, going off into our rivers and our lakes and so forth. None of that, the farmers are having to pick up. You know, all of us are having to then pay for the rivers which have become, contaminated as a result. And of course, you know, the application of pesticides, a huge amount of that ends up, goes into the land, you know, can go into aquifers, goes into waterways. And once again, all of the rest of us, all of society is picking up the costs of having to, you know, clean the water supplies and eliminate all those, the pesticide residues. So the conventional farmer isn't having to pay for the environmental costs of their agriculture, whereas the organic farmer is having to pick up most of the costs. So in a way, organic farmers have been penalized, and not, you know, and they haven't been helped, and they've actually been, you know, it's been harder for them than it has been for conventional farmers. And what we are trying to get the government to do is change the policy framework so that we're actually encouraging organic farming, because the environmental benefits are so huge. I think in the United Kingdom they did a study and said that if all of the farmers converted to organic agriculture in the United Kingdom, there would be savings of in excess of $2 billion every year, just in terms of the environmental savings. So that gives us some idea of the benefits of organic farming from an environmental point of view. And of course it means from a, you know, food safety point of view, they don't contain residues of pesticides, which, is a huge benefit for consumers.
Very good, Sue. I am speaking with Sue Kedgley, who is speaking on behalf of the Green Party on all aspects of health. And I want to go through now from the other end, from, say, the public hospitals. I've been in the hospitals recently, and I found the staff extremely supportive, very friendly, and capable of helping. But I'm still quite concerned at the quality of the food that's served up. I've had the opportunity to witness a lot of the food coming out over the last few months, and I look closely at what food comes out on the trays, and really, there doesn't seem to be much change, particularly as in the New Zealand Herald, recently they've had many articles on leafy greens and eating lots of vegetables twice a day, that you can extend your memory for older people for an extra 5 years if you just eat far more leafy greens. And so have you been able to make any inroads into what foods they have in hospitals? Bearing in mind, a lot of people come in and only stay there for a week or two, but the long-term people who stay in hospital for some months, if they're not eating what you call vital, healthy food, they're not actually getting the nurturement or the nourishment that they require.
Well, and it is extraordinary, isn't it, that in our institutions, which are supposed to be about making us well, that we have food that... Well, isn't the sort of food that, as you say, will make us well, namely the fresh vegetables and so forth. I think that, I mean, we've raised the issue that hospitals and health institutions generally, they should be role models of healthy eating and you know, healthy lifestyles. And of course, they're not. Now, some hospitals have begun to try to move towards this, because what if most hospitals still have, we talked about vending machines, you know, they've got sort of vending machines selling soft drinks and chocolates and whatever, you know, littered through their hospitals. Until recently, you know, there were smoke rooms and so forth. So some of the hospitals have now seriously begun to look at this issue of food, and they are making steps to try to improve the food, but I do think that there's still a long way to go. And of course, you know, I suppose the difficulty is that it takes a bit of effort and indeed money to provide fresh whole vegetables to, you know, all of the patients. And of course, our hospitals are this huge problem of in the health system generally, of underfunding, and of all these district health boards have got these deficits, and so more and more, I think our hospitals are driven by, and health system, by trying to save money to reduce the deficits, rather than thinking about, you know, the long-term issues such as what you raise, which is that you know, that is the food we're serving our patients, is that healthy? But, many of our hospitals have been kept going by the hard work and goodwill of the nursing and other, you know, health staff. I think generally people say that the staff are fantastic, but, you know, this huge resource problems, underfunding, you know, there's, I think we're probably, the nursing organisation estimates we're probably short over New Zealand by about 1,000 nurses. So there's huge strains on the hospital system and enormous financial pressures, and as a result of which people take shortcuts, including with food. And I think the other wider issue is that the health system generally hasn't, I mean, like the Ministry of Health, for example, just has tended until recently to ignore food as being a major underlying cause of ill health. A couple of years ago, the Ministry of Health did a study of the risk, the major risk factors that are contributing to premature death. And the extraordinary thing was that the major, this by a country mile, the leading cause of premature death in New Zealand was poor nutrition, and they estimated it was accounting for 9 to 11,000 premature deaths a year, and way more than all the other factors put together. And, you know, I've said to doctors, I've said to all sorts of people in the health industry, surely if that is that graph, you've produced that graph, if that is the case, surely the major focus of all of your efforts should be on improving the diet and the food that people eat. Because there's the statistics. I mean, it's 400 people, you know, dying on the road, and we have to make a huge national effort to reduce the road toll. Here we've got 9,000 people dying from poor nutrition, and we're making almost no effort, really, to improve the diet and nutrition of New Zealanders. I mean, doctors, you know, maybe have sort of 6 hours on food and nutrition, whereas arguably, if that's the leading cause of death, that should be, you know, one of the major forms of their training and one of the major things that they're concerned about. But, I mean, when you take an animal to a vet, they often will say, well, what have you been feeding the animal? But how often does your doctor say to you, well, what have you been eating?
It is very profound. Because, again, if we were healthy due to eating vital food and lots of exercise, we would not have to go to hospital later on in life.
It's the key preventative tool. I mean, I don't think people realize that, you know, we need the nutrients that we can really only get from food, for our health and well-being, to remain well. We need it. I mean, a lot of people don't even realize this, and particularly children, they just sort of look on energy. But like filling a car with petrol, you know, you just sort of use food to get some energy and to, you know, so that you don't feel hungry. And many people just don't realize the importance of those nutrients, and nor do they realize that it just makes sense. When you highly process food and subject it to those intensely high temperatures, it's going to destroy the nutrients in food. So where are you going to get them from? I mean, some of, you know, like you'll get a breakfast cereal and it will advertise that it's got these vitamins and stuff in it. For most of them, for the highly processed ones that have been through these elaborate extrusion machines, if there are vitamins in it, they will have been added synthetically to the product at the end of the product.
Yes, and then, of course, there's just water. I was in Australia some years ago, and I studied water for a number of years, and to have water that's unchemically contaminated, that has actually got vitality in it, that's got movement in it. The water that we have in New Zealand, of course, though a lot, you know, excellent compared to world standards, still we have too many chemicals in it. Have you any thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, there are places like Christchurch, which just gets their water from an aquifer and it doesn't have any chemicals in it, and similarly Petone, so there are places which don't. But, if you're talking about basically the two things are fluoride and chlorine, when you're providing water to a large urban area, I mean, you do have to kill off the viruses and bacteria. So unfortunately, I can't see a way around disinfecting water in some way. We use chlorine. Fluoride, of course, is completely unnecessary and extraordinary, really, that the government is still on a major campaign to try to fluoridate the remaining water supplies of New Zealand. I mean, I've got no idea why. I mean, if you actually look objectively at the evidence around the world, there's no worse dental hygiene most of Europe doesn't have fluoridated water, if we just give an example, and they don't have worse dental hygiene than we do in New Zealand. I mean, the problems that's causing the huge numbers of children in particular with dental problems is that they're drinking all this rubbish, you know, the sweet drinks or the diet drinks. Those are the things that are caused, and eating so much sugary food. And more our kids are getting addicted to this, you know, high sugar diets, And that, of course, is causing, apart from huge, you know, health problems, it's causing dental problems. Instead of dealing with that issue, you know, the fundamental issue, and of course, poor dental hygiene, you know, many kids aren't taught proper dental hygiene. But those are the ways you combat dental disease, not adding fluoride to our water. And of course, you know, there's more and more controversy about fluoride, more and more studies coming through and suggesting that not only is it not beneficial, but it can be a, you know, significant contributor to, there's various studies saying it can do everything from weaken bones to even some say, well, it could be implicated in cancer. But the issue is, it's not improving dental hygiene. So what on earth are we doing adding it to our water?
I know there's some very strange ones. The world's biggest cola corporation now owns water companies globally.
That's right.
And they have strategically placed themselves in the situation so that possibly when the human race realises that we've actually been destroying ourselves, they will step forward and say, we have the answers. We can give you good quality water. And I might add, they have bought the best quality water companies, particularly in China and over in Australia. So it's
well, they probably also realise that water is a scarce resource, and it's going to be what the wars will be fought about in the future. So they're strategically buying up, you know, all of those key assets.
Very true, yes. And fruit juices, veggie juices. In the last few years, we've seen a proliferation of little fast shops coming up all over Auckland in particular and in other cities where they're just pushing out juices, wheatgrass juice and carrot. Mm. And I think this is
wonderful.
A wonderful idea. It's I mean, Australia have been doing that for some time, and in America, particularly in the health food shops in America, they've been doing it now for 30 years. You could go into a health food shop and get your wheatgrass, and then you could have a carrot and a beetroot and celery and silver beet with a bit of apple, ginger, garlic, and thrown all in. And, of course, it's taken a long time for us here in New Zealand, particularly for athletes, to get onto it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, absolutely fantastic. And you're right. You know, they are more available now. But, I mean, how wonderful if we were all had access to that, because, once again, only people, you know, with a certain income can actually afford to buy these wonderful fresh vegetable juices. But it's a trend, which is fantastic. I think in one of the hospitals they were finally setting something like that up in a hospital, and that's, you know, what should be encouraged, you know, as much as possible all over New Zealand, that we have these vegetable juices, because, you know, that would, if we all were all drinking some of those every day, I'm sure our health bill would, over time, diminish significantly.
But, Sue, we've got so many gardens in New Zealand. Is it because we're just too distracted and doing other things? Because I know, at the moment, I'm running three different little gardens in different places here in Auckland. Sure, there's food mileages in between, but I'm making sure that there's heaps of greens in particular so that we can actually have these, because you can use your... I just get my... silver beet, put it in the freezer for 5 minutes, and then I just add it to my carrots when I put it through the juicer, and it keeps everything cool. It's so sad that we haven't utilised gardens, particularly the lower socioeconomic people who still have got a plot of land outside their house.
It's almost like we've lost, it's one of those skills that we've just lost. We've lost the art of gardening. I mean, I'm sure most people of my age, their parents had a big vegetable garden. It was just part of the culture. And now, it's, you know, people have flower gardens. You know, everyone's got their flower garden, or at least a lot of people have flower gardens, but very few people are growing vegetables. And, you know, this is the key, because you can't get better than growing your own vegetables, particularly in your own composted soil. And, of course, the cost is so, you know, so small. So it really is the solution. And it's interesting in Cuba, where with the blockades and that they couldn't import food, they basically encouraged this, that people had to grow their own food, and they have this thing called urban gardens, and people are growing food in every spare space. I mean, you know, if you think about our cities and that, we could be growing food everywhere. I mean, even in flats, you can have, you can at least be growing herbs in a window box or out on the balconies. But most people, most of us could be growing and really ought to be growing our own gardens. And we need to teach kids how to, you know, most kids don't even know how to recognize a plant. They can't tell you what a zucchini or an asparagus is, or many in surveys have, you know, that's what they've found. So we've got to teach kids, how to recognize, to grow food, and, of course, to cook. I know they did a survey some years ago in America, and they said they found that kids could recognize literally hundreds of corporate logos, but they couldn't recognize the seeds that, or the plants that were growing in their own neighborhood. And this is a symbol, really, of how disconnected we have become with the food supply. And, you know, many kids think that sort of milk comes from fridges. So we've got to reconnect with nature. We've got to reconnect with just simple things like growing our own food and understanding the importance of having, fresh food. Instead of just, I mean, our kids, so many of them are literally becoming addicted to eating highly processed rubbish and thinking that that is normal, healthy food. And we did a survey when the Green Party was releasing our nutrition policy before the election. We did a survey. We took it wasn't really a survey. What we did was we got a nutritionist to work out what would a child, a 14-year-old boy, who was eating a fairly highly processed diet, but nothing too extreme, maybe two cans of soft drinks a day, a pie for lunch, a sort of sugary breakfast cereal, sausages and ice cream for dinner, you know, that sort of thing, and chips, you know, after school chips, that sort of thing. Well, we worked out that a child, a 14-year-old boy eating that sort of highly processed diet would be consuming 70 teaspoons, unbelievable as it may seem, 70 teaspoons of sugar a day and 30 teaspoons of fat and a huge amount of salt. I can't remember how it worked out in teaspoons. But our bodies simply aren't processed, or we're not programmed to cope with that amount of sugar and that amount of fat. So, and then on top of that, all of those foods, most of them or many of them, are almost devoid of nutrients. So what we have is children growing up eating low-nutrient food, high fat, high sugar, really having very little idea about how to cook food or grow food. Is it any wonder that we have such a huge escalating rates of illness in New Zealand? And actually, we've been in the Health Select Committee, which I chair, we've been doing an inquiry into obesity and type 2 diabetes in New Zealand. Many of the experts who have come to us have said, look, we are looking, we're facing a, almost a catastrophe if our children continue to eat what they're eating. You know, basically, if we carry on as we are, our health budget is going to bankrupt the nation, and certainly, dealing with the consequences of it, and particularly with diabetes and so forth, is going to suck up most of the health budget, and there won't be room or won't be money left for the hip replacements, etc. So it is a very serious problem, and I think we're only just beginning to realize how serious it is for the future health of our nation, and how completely unsustainable it is to be basically encouraging a generation of New Zealanders to grow up so that they will be unhealthy and a drain on the health system.
Yes, couch potatoes. Mm.
That's right. I mean, quite apart from, we haven't even talked about the lack of physical exercise and the fact that, you know, kids don't walk to school anymore and lie around, you know, playing games and watching television. So, you know, we have to change these lifestyles, or you know, the future of New Zealand and, you know, most other Western nations really is at risk.
So the New Zealand animal farming, including dairy, accounts for 51% of greenhouse gases, but the industry is only worth about 20% of our current earnings. In a carbon neutral world, do you think that we place too much emphasis on these products, particularly meat and dairy?
Well, I do think that, I mean, if the experts are right about climate change, and if they're correct in saying that we are going to, in New Zealand and around the world, have to reduce our carbon emissions by anywhere from 70 to 90% by 2030. I mean, that's what they're saying, if we are to avert, you know, not to get into the, you know, disastrous areas where, you know, there's an increase in climate of more than 2%, 2 to 3%. We are going to have to look at all of these things, and I think one of the things we're going to have to look at is whether we all need to eat so much meat, because it does seem to me, you know, sure, someone wrote a letter saying, well, look, you know, we've got to feed the world, you know, we can't be penalised for our methane emissions because we're feeding the world. But we don't all have to eat meat, and actually some people are saying that meat production is a greater cause of climate change, arguably, than even transport and our, you know, use of cars, because around the world we're clearing rainforest still all over the world to make way for meat production, for dairy production. So I do think we're going to have to rethink this, and I think we're going to have to move to much more plant-based diets, and we in New Zealand will no doubt have to do this as well as everywhere else, because, you know, you're right, it's 50% of our emissions, and, you know, we're expecting other sectors. We're starting to think about it in terms of transport and saying that we must start encouraging public transport, electrifying as much of our public transport as we can, etc. We can't just say to the farming industry we're going to turn a blind eye.
Very true, yes. So, the Green website, have you thought about having a facet on a particular page so that people can go up and say, okay, now I want to get some oils, cooking oils or whatever, and I can look up and see what oils can you... Is there a chance that they could have a recommended food page, so that anybody who had any thoughts or challenges around food that could go up and have a look and instantly get clarity as to what choice they make for a food?
Well, I mean, we are a political party, and we're focused on trying to bring about political change. We're not a bunch of nutritionists advising on nutrition. We do have a whole quite extensive under our Safe Food campaign. We've got quite as extensive information, perhaps not as extensive as that, and it's perhaps something we could think about. But really, as a political party, we have to be focused on trying to make the changes at a political level, and that's what we have been focused on. But we do, you know, we do have, as I say, a lot of information is up on our website. Perhaps we need more, but I do think that there are many websites which, just give information on that sort of information about health and nutrition and, you know, what people can and should be eating. And maybe we should give some, but that isn't our primary purpose as a political party.
Yes, I understand.
I mean, I've written a book, Eating Safely in a Toxic World, and it deals with all of those issues. We've got whole things on additives to avoid and on many issues up on our Safe Food section of our website.
Yes. Well, Sue, in closing, this has been a good year for the environment, for our planet, for raising consciousness to the fact that these environmental challenges that we've been talking about for 35 plus years, now all of a sudden a breakthrough. I'm feeling very confident that we can bring about change. How do you and the Green Party feel, just for in a couple of minutes?
Well, I agree with you that really, you know, it has been amazing that things that we have been talking about for years, and which people have sort of yawned and, you know, rolled their eyes and, you know, or dismissed as being irrelevant or radical, are now suddenly mainstream issues right there on the political agenda. I mean, we're absolutely delighted, and we believe that to a very substantial effect in New Zealand anyway, it's the presence of the Greens in Parliament constantly raising these issues, which has eventually led to, you know, both National and Labour deciding that these are critical issues. And of course, there are many other factors as well, including Al Gore's film, which I think has had a huge impact. So it's almost been like a bit of a tipping point. There has really been a very significant increase in people's understanding. And I guess it's also just all the research and science that's coming out, which is, you know, is becoming irrefutable about the threat of climate change. So I agree with you that finally people are becoming aware and concerned. And I think also that even some of the, I mean, everyone has, or almost everyone has, children or grandchildren, or certainly within their families. And it doesn't matter if you're the richest person in the world, if you're a Rupert Murdoch and you can flit around in your private jet and live the life of Riley. The truth is that you have children and grandchildren, and if we are leaving them a world which is basically uninhabitable, I mean, what a terrible legacy. So I think even some of the, you know, the wealthy and the powerful are starting to think, hang on, we do have an obligation, our generation, to leave our children with a planet that is inhabitable, that actually has, you know, air, clean air and clean water and food, and you know, whose atmosphere is not at risk. So I think finally we are waking up to this, and hopefully this will result in you know, in a real shift. Well, it is resulting in a shift in consciousness and in strong political action. There is a lot of talk, but seriously, I mean, what most experts are saying is that in New Zealand, the most conservative scenario would be that we would need to stabilise our emissions over the next 3 years. They're still, you know, rocketing up. And then we would have to reduce by 5% every single year for the next, until 2030, if we were to just to avert disaster. And we haven't even begun to take the measures that will be needed to do that. But at least we're talking about it, at least there's an understanding, and hopefully within the next couple of years we will start to see really significant change, and, you know, people giving up their addiction to the motor car and really seriously investing in public transport, all of those sorts of things, you know, insulating our homes, having solar energy, having wind energy, you know, switching to renewable resources. New Zealand, we're almost unique in the world. We could be one of the first countries in the world to be totally, you know, to getting our energy from renewable sources. It's entirely, you know, that is feasible in New Zealand. You know, let's galvanize as a nation to do that.